A collaboration between musician David Rothenberg and Native American thrushes and warblers, the piece Temperate Woodland. It was recorded at the National Aviary in Pittsburgh. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, June 15th, 2007, the Chicago Tribune reports that a statistical analysis of two long-range bird censuses, one by the United States Geological Survey and one by the Audubon Society, has found a disturbing decline in populations of many species of birds over the last 40 years. Among the findings in Illinois, the population of bobolinks dropped 97%. Eastern meadowlarks fell by 87%. In this portion of the program, we are going to turn our attention to our birds. The unsung heroes of our world are songbirds. That's the word from biologist Bridget Stutchbury. In her book, Silence of the Songbirds, Stutchbury examines the role songbirds play in the environment and how their precipitous population decline is a sign that the world's ecosystems are under a great deal of stress. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Bridget Stutchbury, is professor of biology at York University in Toronto. Recognized as an international birding expert, she is affiliated with more than a dozen organizations working to preserve bird habitats. Her book, Silence of the Songbirds, is published by Walker and Company. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Bridget Stutchbury, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be speaking to you.
The analysis I mentioned is of bird populations in the U.S., this U.S. Geological Survey and the Audubon Society bird censuses. What's the situation elsewhere in the world? Is it similar?
Yes, these bird declines that we've noted in the United States and in Canada, I would add, have also been noted in Great Britain and in Australia. These long-term bird counts that we get the information from, we're really lucky that they've been going on so long in the United States since the 1960s. Great Britain has been doing it for a long time, but there aren't that many countries that have been counting birds for that long. So we have really good information on what's happening to them.
Yeah. How is this information collected and then analyzed over time?
Well, one of the most popular censuses is called the Breeding Bird Survey, and I think that's one of the ones you're referring to. This was started in the 1960s after Rachel Carson alerted the world to disappearing birds, and we realized we better start counting them if they're such good indicators of environmental problems. And so the volunteers go out in early June, and the census set survey area going along a road and stopping and listening for birds as they go. And there's over 2,000 breeding bird survey routes that are done each year in North America. And everyone uses exactly the same methods and goes exactly the same distance and listens for exactly the same amount of time. So it allows really good comparisons from year to year and from place to place.
So they're pretty accurate then?
Yes, they are. It's a quick and dirty method of counting. It's not as good as spending hours and hours in one place counting every single bird that lives there. But given that volunteers are doing the work and they don't get any pay for this, they cover a very large area, and it gives us a rough idea of what's happening with bird populations. And certainly the bobolinks are going downhill, the meadowlarks, mm-hmm. and really dozens of other species, too, are declining.
These numbers are really striking. Bobolinks in Illinois dropping 97%, eastern meadowlarks by 87%. Are these birds on their way to extinction?
I think they're on their way. When we see bird populations, I think over the their entire breeding range, they're not declining as badly everywhere as they are in Illinois. But even on a continent-wide picture, if you stand back and look at the entire continent, these two species have been declining over the last 40 years. And it's not normal for bird populations to go down and down and down and down. Normally, a bird population, it'll have good years and bad years, and they sort of cancel each other out, and the populations stay relatively steady over the long haul. And that's what's so wonderful about these bird counts. We've been doing it for so long in exactly the same way that these 40-year declines that we see tell us that if we don't change something now, we can look 40 years into the future and take a pretty good guess at what the bird situation is going
to
be.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for us to realize, to think about this, because, you know, in my backyard, I have lots of birds, but some birds are apparently more at risk than others. Why are the bobolinks and the eastern meadowlarks, for example, more at risk? Why are their numbers declining so precipitously as compared to other species that I have that are plentiful?
Well, for a lot of our birds that are declining, the sort of common problem that they face is habitat loss. And for our grassland birds, like the bobolinks and meadowlarks, the natural grasslands that are their normal habitat are virtually gone. And now they move in and try to build nests in fields where we're growing hay and other crops. When we come in and mow the hay midway through the season, that ruins all the bird nests. They basically lose their habitat in one afternoon of mowing. And then the grass comes up again. They try to re-nest, and someone comes along and mows. And so the farming, which we need to do, is not very compatible with the nesting that the birds need to do. And there just aren't enough areas that are unmown to really sustain healthy populations.
Mm. And migrating birds, they're also, they've got essentially the same situation in the areas that they live in, both here and there.
Right. Well, bobolinks are a good example. They go all the way to South America in the wintertime. So they have a very, very long trip. And unfortunately, they go all the way down to Bolivia, so it's a very, very long way. And unfortunately, recent studies of researcher in Vermont has found that on their wintering grounds, the bobolinks spend a lot of time eating rice. Again, their natural grasslands have been converted into agricultural fields, and rice is one of the big crops there. And so bobolinks are going into fields and eating the seeds there, and they're inadvertently getting poisoned by the pesticides that are sprayed on these crops. And particularly in Latin America, and on the wintering grounds, really nasty pesticides are used, chemicals that are really toxic to birds and often not even allowed to be used here. So these birds are kind of moving out of a breeding area where, you know, pesticide regulations or at least eliminating some of the worst pesticides and spending the winter in areas where it's almost a free-for-all in terms of what can be used on the crops. And certainly very large numbers of bobolinks are being poisoned by pesticides, and so they've got problems on their breeding grounds. And then they go all the way down to South America, and they face different kinds but equally severe problems down there.
Yeah. I want to talk with you more about pesticides in a moment here, but why do these birds migrate so far?
Well, it's a good question. You would think that these birds could be lazy and all kind of pile up in Florida like humans do, I think, in the wintertime. The trouble is geography. If you look at the shape of North America and Central America, it looks like a funnel. So you have this huge continent, you know, Canada and the United States, and a huge area, you know, used to be covered in forest and beautiful grasslands, and it could support enormous numbers of breeding birds. In the wintertime, they leave because there's not enough food to keep them alive during our cold winters, and all these birds have to cram into this tiny area. You think of, Panama and Costa Rica and southern Mexico. It's just a tiny strip of land, and I think a lot of birds overshoot Central America and go all the way to South America because, again, they're competing for space and for food with each other.
Hmm. Pesticides. A moment ago you mentioned Rachel Carson. Are they as serious a problem today as they were when she was ringing alarm bells?
I think they are, but for different reasons. We use different kinds of chemicals today, and it's important to know that the chemicals we use today are, in one sense, not as dangerous because they don't build up in the food chain. You know, it's something like DDT that Rachel Carson warned us about. That's actually stored inside your body, and it's stored inside cow's milk and butter and cheese. You can find it in your food stored there. And an apple orchard that was sprayed 20 years ago still has DDT in it today. The stuff just hangs around forever. And one of the reasons that that those kinds of chemicals were so incredibly dangerous is because they lasted so long. The pesticides today don't last very long. They're designed to break down quickly. But in order to do their job, and that is to kill things quickly, they have to be really toxic. So I think the modern-day chemicals are very dangerous because they have such very high toxicity, and the birds that are exposed to them during those hours or days that the chemicals are active face really high death rates if they come into contact with these things.
Do we know how many birds are killed?
It's hard to know, but some studies have gone to cornfields, for instance. This is dating back 10 or 15, 20 years when carbofuran was a very popular pesticide that was applied to cornfields in the United States, and it's very toxic to birds. And just a handful of studies would go out look for dead birds, basically, in cornfields before the pesticides were applied, and then go back and look afterwards and try to actually come up with a hard number of how many birds were being killed. And on a given field, they might find 30 or 40 birds being killed over the course of a summer, which doesn't sound like much, but of course when you think about the huge areas that are planted in corn, the estimates were in the hundreds of millions of birds being killed each summer as a result of the huge area that was being sprayed with the treated with carbofuran. Mm. That chemical's not used anymore for growing corn because it's so toxic for birds. We have alternatives which aren't quite so bad. So that's the good news, that there are alternatives, and when we learn of these kinds of problems, we can switch.
Yeah. In addition to fatality, is there also risk of birds being affected in other ways? I'm thinking back to when we were using DDT. That led to problems in reproduction,
right,
for birds.
There are some examples. Again, surprisingly little. You would think there would be more known about it, and I was surprised when I was researching my book how little is known about the effects of pesticides on wild birds. It's a difficult thing to study, and I think to some extent people have kind of put pesticides in the back of their minds. There's a very common lawn chemical called acephate, which is used very widely today. And one researcher did an experiment with migrating sparrows, and he put them in a little cage, and it was during migration. Birds can see the stars, so they navigate. You put them outside, and they try to go in the correct direction, so they're trying to head south. When these birds were exposed to acephate, they couldn't tell north from south. And it was really, no one would have guessed that these lawn chemicals actually disrupt the navigation system of our birds, which makes you wonder how many birds are going astray and getting lost during migration. So that's one example. Yeah, another example was a study that looked at forests that were being treated for spruce budworm. And a lot of the birds that were breeding in the forest, after it was sprayed, abandoned their territories. Females stopped taking care of their eggs. So it really disrupted not so much the hatching of the eggs like DDT, but it just completely sort of shut down their parental behavior, and they produced very few offspring. So they're really serious side effects of these chemicals that we really don't know a great deal about.
Yeah, and these are suspects now in the mystery of the honeybees that don't return to the hive.
Right. The chemicals are, a lot of these pesticides have been implicated in the honeybee declines, the bumblebee declines, even frogs, you know, the famous story of frogs disappearing from the highland forests in Costa Rica. You know, what could be causing the golden toad to disappear from Costa Rica. There's no people around. Well, it turns out that pesticides are being carried, you know, up into the mountains in the rain and dumped down into areas in the middle of the forest. And so these pesticides could have really sweeping effects that are difficult to study because they're not stored in the body. So it's a little trickier to sort of nail down the culprits.
Mm. In terms of our choices at the grocery store or at the farmer's market, in terms of food, are there things that we can do to help improve the situation for
Yeah, I think there's sort of two main things we can do. One is to be careful where our food comes from. Buying local is a very popular choice to try, especially in the summertime. That's easy to do. In the winter, it's harder to buy produce that's grown locally. And certainly from the point of view of pesticide use, it is true that the regulations for what kinds of pesticides are used are better in the United States than in many parts of Latin America. And certainly if you look at the pesticide residues on foods, the foods imported from Latin America are three times more likely to fail the EPA standards than locally produced produce. So certainly buying local is a good idea. And certain crops use heavy doses of pesticides that are bad for birds, or types of pesticides like diazinon that's bad for birds. So if you have a chance, if it's available and you can buy organic, crops like Brussels sprouts and cranberries and blueberries, for instance, potatoes, those are types of crops that tend to use quantities or types of pesticides that are very dangerous for birds. And so if we choose organic for those products, we can really make a difference.
Mm. Biologist Bridget Stutchbury is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a professor of biology at York University in Toronto. She's an international birding expert, and she is the author of Silence of the Songbirds, the book published by Walker & Company. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. One of the species that you've spent a good deal of time studying is the purple martin. Tell us about witnessing what you call in the book a living storm of martins.
Purple martins are large swallows, and a lot of people enjoy them in their backyards. They live in apartment houses, basically, in your backyard. They have this fabulous behavior late in the summer. They gather together in these enormous clouds for sleeping at night. So when they're done with their houses, they find nice marshes or areas along lake shores and descend in huge numbers. And if you go out in your canoe, like if you know where one of these roosts are, you can go out in your canoe just before sunset, and you see all these dots way high in the sky. You can barely tell they're birds. And as it gets darker and darker, they start swirling around and around in huge waves. And as it starts to get dark, they just drop out of the sky. It looks like a tornado funnel as they're coming down into the marsh. And when we go out canoeing and look at the roost up close, there are just thousands of birds swirling around you. You can almost reach out and touch them as they race by. And I think it's one of the few opportunities that the people have to kind of get up close and personal and really appreciate some of the huge numbers of these birds and how they gather like this late in the summer.
Yeah. Once upon a time, the passenger pigeon numbered in the billions, and now it's extinct. I wonder, you know, as I was reading your book, what would it have been like to have experienced a living storm of passenger pigeons?
The descriptions of passenger pigeons sound like they're from a science fiction book or something, a fantasy book. These colonies of passenger pigeons, and they occurred in Illinois and Ontario, places that, where you live and where I live. The forests that they occupied, they had 20 or 30 nests in a single tree, and that kind of nesting density would occur over an area that might be 10 miles wide and 20 miles long. So it's almost impossible to imagine, you know, billions of pigeons all concentrated in that one area. the Audubon, the famous ornithologist of that time, describes hearing the flock coming towards the nesting areas, and it just absolutely was deafening. And as flocks flew overhead, they would darken the sky for 4, 8, 10 hours at a time. It was almost like a solar eclipse was taking place. And we read that today and almost shake our heads going, oh, come on, they must be exaggerating. They weren't exaggerating. You can talk to us kind of old-timers today who still remember what the waves of migratory warblers and thrushes were like 50 or 60 years ago. Today's migration is just a tiny amount compared to what people alive today remember from their childhood. So the numbers have been dropping, and we are losing our birds.
When did we lose the passenger pigeon, and what happened to it?
We basically lost them at the end of the 1800s. I think the last one died in 1912 or something in that neighborhood. But really, the huge flocks collapsed over the course of the 1800s, and that's the same time when the forests were being cut in such huge quantities. Passenger pigeons had this sort of strange nomadic lifestyle where they would settle in one area in one summer and breed there and not return for decades to that same place. So each summer, these huge flocks would find a different place to breed, and it might be hundreds of miles away from where they were the year before. And this kind of wandering lifestyle required huge expanses of intact forest. And when people came and started chopping up the forest into small pieces, there just wasn't enough left to sustain these kinds of numbers of passenger pigeons.
Mm. You tell the story in the book of a very interesting collapse of vultures, a catastrophic collapse of three kinds of vultures in India and Pakistan in the 1990s. What happened there?
This is a real strange story. We don't usually admire vultures very much. They're not much to look at, and certainly their eating habits aren't so great either from our point of view. But the vultures in India and Pakistan, over a period of about 10 years, collapsed by 80 to 90%. That's on the same kind of scale that you mentioned for the bobolinks and meadowlarks. Over a period of 10 years, boom, the populations are practically gone. And it was a real mystery. At first, people wondered if it was some sort of disease, some bird disease that they were spreading to each other, some kind of virus, we weren't sure. And it turned out that the culprit was a medicine that was being given to cattle. It's a blood thinner called diclofenac, which is, I think, a medicine that people use as well. And for some reason, in that part of the world, it's popular to use it for cattle. And it turns out that this causes liver failure in vultures. Who would have guessed? But it's another example of a chemical contaminant that we use, not realizing what kind of impact it has on the environment. And, of course, when the vultures disappeared, there's nobody there to take their place and eat all the carcasses that pile up. And you don't really realize what an important job vultures do until they're not around being sanitation workers and taking away the garbage for us. And they had huge outbreaks of rabies, for instance, after the vultures crashed. And the vultures still haven't recovered. I think the problem continues today.
Mm. Let's take a call now. A listener is waiting to talk with us in Mattoon, Illinois, on line 4. Good afternoon. You're on the air with Bridget Suchbury.
Well, thank you, and I'm enjoying your show. It's very informative. My question is I'm a bird watcher. My family's a bird watcher. We own farm property. We have a cabin on it, and I have a tick infestation. And earlier you had made a comment about diazinon being rather harmful to the birds, and I already knew that. But any idea how I can control these things? I don't want to spray and do the ecological damage to the wildlife that I have out there. I do have a number of species that live on the property. I've got owls and hawks, and I've got kingbirds and different species that are out there, and I really would like to be able to control this tick infestation, but yet not harm my wildlife. And I'll hang up and hope you can get me a good answer. Thank you.
Hmm.
Now, there's one product that we use sometimes for our purple martin colonies. They nest in wooden birdhouses and also get these tick infestations. And we use 7. It's a powder that you can use for putting on your gardening. And so far, it doesn't seem like this has a really serious impact or any impact that we can measure at all on the birds. It's a chemical that's not especially toxic to birds, and we just put it inside the nest, underneath the nesting material, and that seems to take care of the parasites that are in the nest, and the young seem to do fine, and the parents do fine, and I think that would be fairly safe to try.
Okay. Best of luck on that. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Bridget Stuchbury, author of Silence of the Songbirds. Other phone calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, we've talked now about chemicals, and we've talked a little bit about habitat fragment. Well, we haven't really talked about fragmentation, but about disappearance of habitat. There are many other threats to songbirds. In fact, you report there are almost too many to count. Besides habitat loss, besides the pesticide problem, and even with the vultures in India and Pakistan, the chemical problem there that was used for to treat human beings and livestock, what are some of the other culprits behind the decline in birds?
Well, one of the big problems the birds face is when they sort of come near our own backyards and our cities. North America, of course, is dotted with large cities that have sprung up in the last few hundred years. When birds fly at night, especially these little songbirds, they fly at night because the air is cool and calm and it's a safe time for them to fly, and they use stars to navigate. When they come near cities, especially on cloudy or foggy nights, they can't really see the stars, and instead they see the bright lights from our buildings, and they head towards those bright lights. Same with the brightly lit communication towers, the big TV antennas. If they're brightly lit, sometimes they attract birds at night. Then the birds fly around and around the lighted area and get exhausted and either crash into the towers or the guy lines or crash into the building. Chicago is a good example where they've had, you know, large numbers of birds dying as a result of collisions with buildings, and Toronto has the same problem, and New York City has the same problem. So just the mere presence of these large cities is a real problem. Hundreds of millions of birds are killed every year as they try to pass two times through this urban obstacle course as they head south and then come back north again.
What can we do about that?
The simple thing we can do is try to turn our lights off at night, especially in these large cities. A lot of the lights are on not because people are actually inside the buildings, but they're office towers or their outdoor lighting that are so-called vanity lighting to sort of make the sky, the city night scene look attractive. And turning off the lights at night, especially during migration, can really help the birds and reduce the numbers that are killed. I know Chicago has a lights out program where a lot of the major buildings have turned off their lighting at night when nobody's in there, and certainly Toronto is doing the same thing, turning off the lights so that birds can have safe passage through the city, reasonably speaking.
Wind farms are now something that we're turning to look at as an alternative source for our energy needs. Are these a problem, and how significant, and is there any way to work around that problem?
Yeah, wind turbines are a real concern because they're increasing in number by the hundreds, by the thousands, going up everywhere. For birds, at least, so far, the wind farms that already have been constructed, when people go and look for evidence of dead birds, the way we find them at TV towers or city buildings, we're not finding hundreds or thousands of dead birds lying around under these wind turbines. And people have searched very large wind turbine farms and only found, you know, a dozen or so dead songbirds. And so on the one hand, this is really good news that at least so far, it looks as though the turbines have not caused a massive problem. We need to be really careful where we put them because birds kind of fly along migratory pathways at night. We can't see them, but they use certain areas more heavily than others, and we have to be really careful that we study these migration patterns before we put up the wind turbines to make sure that we don't stick them right in the middle of a bird highway.
Would a possible solution be to turn these things off during a period of migration?
Yes, it makes perfect sense to turn the wind turbines off, especially at night. Usually the wind levels are pretty low at night anyhow, and so one presumes that it would be a pretty good trade-off to turn the turbines off at night when the birds are flying and then put them back on in the daytime. And again, the peak migration season is only a couple months in the fall and another couple months in the spring. And the rest of the year, there isn't a large-scale migration movement. So I think the advantages of wind turbines in terms of renewable energy sources and the possibility of kind of managing them by putting them in safer areas and turning them off at night if problems are detected, I think we can make the wind turbines work without hurting a lot of birds.
Mm. Another problem for birds is predators.
One of the biggest predators are domestic cats, people's pet cats. Most people who own cats and let them outdoors probably have stories to tell about the small birds that are brought back from time to time. And I think the problem with cats is twofold. One is that there are just so many of them. In almost any suburban or rural area where birds might find themselves, there's going to be a lot of cats roaming around, and it's been estimated again, that hundreds of millions of songbirds are killed every year by people's pet cats. And a simple solution is to keep your cats indoors. One of the features of these migratory songbirds that makes them especially vulnerable is that when they're migrating, moving back and forth, they get exhausted, understandably. And during the daytime, you know, they're completely focused on trying to find food. And bird watchers love this because when you get birds... Mm-hmm. During migration, you can get really close to them. They don't seem shy all of a sudden. They're so tired and so starving that you can get very close and get good looks at them. But it also means that the cats can get close to them. And I think a lot of these songbirds are killed during migration by cats and other kinds of, native predators as well.
Yeah. Let's take another call now. A listener on a cell phone. Line one, hi.
Hello. I think you passed over the question of animals. I read something the other day that cats probably kill 10 or 15 times as many birds as the wind tunnels or the wind energy things kill. And I certainly have lose a lot of birds in my backyard from neighbors' cats.
The cats are a huge problem. I know, especially when you combine the abundance of cats with habitat loss. Cats, of course, live around people, and because there are so many people living now in the United States, it's hard for a songbird to find any patch of forest or grassland where there isn't some farmhouse or suburban area nearby. It's hard for them to get away from us. And so most of our songbirds, when they come and nest, very likely are going to come face-to-face with cats, and you're certainly right to... The cats and even running into buildings and TV towers cause a lot more mortality right now than wind turbines. But we still need to be careful where we put these wind turbines so we don't create a big problem for the future.
Well, I agree, but I think that people ought to be careful about letting their cats outside.
I agree. They should keep them indoors, and you're not allowed to let your dog roam around outside in most places, and maybe we should have the same laws for cats.
Well, it's better for the cats, too.
Yeah, they live longer if you keep them indoors.
They sure do.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the call.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Bye-bye. Next, we talk with a listener in Spring Bay on line four. Hi.
Oh, good afternoon. I've been enjoying some kestrels here for the past couple of years, and this year they had three chicks, and I thought that was pretty amazing. I thought they'd only have one. Do you know anything about kestrels and how their numbers are doing and that sort of thing? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
I think kestrels are one of the success stories, along with some of our other falcons. They got hurt really badly by DDT and some of these older chemicals that build up in the food chain. And as top carnivores, you know, animals that eat other animals, they were getting really heavy doses of DDT and similar chemicals. And kestrels were among the hawks who they found that DDT, it wasn't that it was so toxic, it's that it prevented the eggs from hatching. And so it really shut down reproduction. And since DDT was banned in the early 1970s, kestrels have bounced back, peregrine falcons have bounced back, bald eagles have bounced back. For anyone who lives around the Great Lakes, cormorants have bounced back, which, you know, not everybody enjoys. But, you know, these the birds that eat fish and other animals really have bounced back. And so I think they're in pretty good shape. Kestrels also enjoy, if people want to try it, we have a nest box in one of our fields for kestrels. If you make a very, very large bird box, you know, sort of like you would have for a tree swallow bluebird, but make it five times bigger, sometimes you can get kestrels nesting in boxes that you put out in fields. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, the red-tailed hawk now is not an uncommon sight in my backyard.
Right. Red-tailed hawks are not especially shy, and you know, you often see them along the roadsides when you're on these long summer trips. It's nice to see the red-tailed hawks perching along the side of the road, and they seem to be very abundant, certainly.
Yeah, their numbers must be up.
Yeah, at least compared, you know, like we have to, compared to the 1960s, yes, these hawks, on the most part, have recovered from probably the, you know, near extinction for many of them. Certainly the peregrine falcon and bald eagle was just about, you know, maybe a decade away from not being around anymore as a result of this pesticide use. So it's a success story that if we recognize the cause of the problem and make immediate changes, that these birds, because they lay quite a few eggs, their populations have that resilience, the ability to bounce back as long as we can fix the problems.
Yeah. But the whole picture, there is a certain amount of fragility here in ecosystems. And one of the things that I think that is one of the things that comes through in your book really loud and clear. And it's interesting to note that in the 1970s, you write, ecologists believed that migratory birds were interlopers in the tropics, and then we came to realize that they are significant players in the tropics. Here's the question I'd like to ask you now. How do ecologists go about and biologists go about discovering the links between species and how they came to be?
Well, one of the ways we can understand how important birds are in their communities is to stop them from doing their jobs and see what happens. And this is kind of what happened with the vultures, although we never planned that. Get rid of the vultures and you see how important they are. With the little songbirds, people have done studies where you cover up, and they've done this in the tropics too, you put netting over the plants and stop the birds from coming in and eating the insects, for instance. So you want to know how important are birds in eating insects? How good are they in controlling the bugs? So if you stop them from doing that job, most people find that the number of insects doubles and that the growth rate of the trees goes down because the insects are eating the leaves, which means the tree can't grow as well. One study on spruce budworm found that songbirds, like the little warblers, colorful warblers that are in the forest, were eating 86% of these caterpillars. Spruce budworms are one of these pest insects, like tent caterpillars, that have these huge outbreaks from time to time and gobble up the forest. And under normal conditions, birds are eating, you know, about 90% almost of these caterpillars and keeping them in check. So one of the reasons we should be so worried that our warblers and flycatchers and orioles are disappearing is that it basically is going to mean the insects are going to win and be able to devour our trees.
Let's take another call. A listener in Belgium, line 4, hi.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
I wanted to point out that the vultures are doing very well over here on East Central Illinois. We have lots of them over here, and they do almost winter over anymore. But the point I really wanted to bring up the most is that north of Danville, we have a very excellent little bird sanctuary that has been built up by the water company we have, and it's called Heron Park. And it's a water, a kind of a wetlands-type place. It has a lot of birds. But the unfortunate thing is the city decided to put improve the road that went by it. And it's pretty much chased the herons away because blue heron don't really like people so much. And the nesting site they had there is close enough to the road that they don't tend to stay anymore. But other than that, it's a beautiful place to go see birds.
Yes, some of our birds, like the the blue heron that you mentioned are very sensitive and don't like being around people. You know, we mentioned earlier in the show that you look out in your backyard and you see robins and orioles, and those birds don't mind being in our backyards. It's harder to see some of the shyer birds like wood thrush, and even you think of black ducks. Traditionally, they're very shy birds, and again, even if there's a forest patch or a nice marsh nearby, if there's a busy road or homes nearby, then the birds won't use that habitat because they don't like having us around.
Exactly right. This spot also had a nesting set of eagles for a while. Unfortunately, the tree blew down that the nest was in, but those things happen there. But just wanted to point out that if people do like to get out and do birding, it's a just absolutely amazing place. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for that. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest today is Bridget Stutchbury. Before we wrap up, I want you to talk about the importance of shade coffee. This is something I knew was, as a consumer, good thing to do, but I didn't know how important it can be in helping songbirds.
Yeah, coffee nowadays is usually grown out in the open, like you'd grow corn. But 20 or 30 years ago, most of our coffee was grown in the traditional way, and that's under the shade of tropical trees. It's usually a shade-loving plant. And the reason that shade coffee helps our birds is because in so many areas, the natural rainforest, the natural tropical forest, is completely gone. And the only thing left for miles around are these little patches of shade coffee farms. Shade coffee farms can be home to 30 or 40 different species of our migratory songbirds. And so it provides a really important lifeboat for our migrants who otherwise would have nowhere to spend the winter. It also tastes a lot better than sun-grown coffee, so we have a good reason to buy it. But it's a wonderful way of increasing the amount of habitat for our migrants by buying shade coffee. The farmers can afford to grow this specialty coffee, and it also creates better farming conditions because the sun-grown coffee needs a lot of pesticides, it needs a lot of fungicides, needs a lot of fertilizer. A lot of the soil gets washed off during the heavy tropical rains, and so farmers who try to grow sun coffee usually find after 10 or 15 years that their farm's in pretty bad shape, whereas the guys who are growing shade coffee have a more of a natural system that's more sustainable for themselves in the long run and more sustainable for birds, too.
Mm. Win-win situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, how big a difference could that make if we went more and more to shade coffee?
I think it's got huge potential. North Americans drink about 300 million cups of coffee a day.
Wow!
So even if you just had 10% of us decide asking for and wanting to consume shade coffee, you know, it might cost an extra 10 cents a cup. But you know, many of us wouldn't mind paying that, especially if we love birds and knowing that it helps our birds when they're not here. So the huge coffee consumption and market means that even a small change in our coffee drinking habits is going to do a lot of help, not just for the birds, as I said, but for the farmers as well, who actually make more money if they grow shade coffee.
Hmm. Anything you want to leave us with to wrap up with here?
Yeah, I think if I can throw out an interesting but scary statistic, if we look at our track record over the last 400 years, say, how many birds have gone extinct in the last 400 or 500 years? Well, it's only 1%, you know, maybe about 100 or so. If you look to the future and say, how many species are going to go extinct by the end of this century, it's more like 15%. So we're at a dramatic turning point where we've been kind of chugging along, cutting down forests and growing our own populations. But the problems that we've seen up to now are just the tip of the iceberg. And over the course of the next decades, these problems are just going to accelerate. And it's really scary to know that that a lot of these species could be extinct by the time our kids are our age.
Hmm. And all the unintended consequences that might, all the things that might happen as a result of that.
Yeah,
we don't know.
We can't afford to, you know, we can't have natural, healthy forests and grasslands without the birds. And if they disappear, we're not just losing birds. We're going to start losing, you know, the plants that depend on them.
Hmm. There, we'll leave it. Bridget, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
No, you're welcome.
Bridget Stuchbury is a professor of biology at York University in Toronto. She's an international birding expert. She's affiliated with more than a dozen organizations working to preserve bird habitats. And she's the author of Silence of the Songbirds. The book is published by Walker & Company.